Once again, we go back to the Imperial Church, which we started last week with the conversion of Constantine to the faith, or what we think is to the faith. And so tonight we're going to continue our look at that second phase of the church, the Imperial Church. Now, I want to just pause for a moment and point out that it is my intention in this series to cast a very wide net as to the kinds of things we're going to be talking about. There is massive detail, even in the subjects we're going to be talking about, that we could uncover and discuss and go through. But I'm trying to make this series less than a 25-year thing, because you really could, with all the details, take that long. So the goal is just to give you a feel for the church as it passes through time. And then if you want to do more research of a particular topic, then there are plenty of church history books that have been written through the years that I could recommend that you could look at. There's going to be a number of individuals along the way, even in the topics we're going to talk about tonight, that would be worth discussing. But we're going to have to pass over them, because we really want to just focus on the most important matters in the situation. Now, the conversion of Constantine around 300 or so has done away mostly, not completely, but mostly with persecution in the empire. And Christianity has become, at this point, the de facto standard religion in the empire. It is not the official religion of the empire. That was never declared, contrary to popular belief. But it has become the de facto standard. I mean, after all, if the emperor is a Christian, then certainly Christians feel more empowered to live out their faith publicly. And the rest of society feels like, well, if the emperor is a Christian, then I need to be one too. And so it becomes the de facto religion of the empire. Many, therefore, have embraced Christianity. Notice I put that in air quotes, embraced Christianity in order to be a part of the life of the empire. And the church now finds herself enjoying a relatively newfound period of peace and prosperity. All of that persecution having gone away, and Christianity having sort of risen up to become something important in people's lives, this has had a tremendous impact, or will have a tremendous impact, on the church herself. I mean, you remember, for 300 years, the church has been on the run, quite literally, being chased by the authorities. People have been martyred for following after Christ. Churches have been underground, and there's been a number of things that have taken place. And the church prospered in that time, theologically, as well as by the promulgation of Scripture. But now, something entirely new has come to play. And so as we turn the corner into the fourth century of human history, fourth century after Christ, we come to see some issues that arise from that reality. So I've entitled my lecture tonight, The Controversies of the Imperial Church. There are some early controversies that arise as a result of this change that has taken place with the church becoming the de facto religion of the empire. The first of these is known as the monastic movement. The word monk comes from the Greek word monachos, which means solitary. A monk is an individual who wishes to escape from the ordinary life of the world to a place of meditation and discipline. Monasticism then became a fourth century movement of people who went away from the church in the population centers, in the major cities in the Roman Empire, to places of solitude, to places of confinement, to places where they could be by themselves in order to meditate and to learn and to escape, if you will, all of the issues related to the church now being so integrated with society. There were many who now said, in reaction to this swinging, if you will, of the church into a time of peace and prosperity, that they needed to escape from that and go and live in a place where they would not be tempted by the world, as the church herself was now being tempted by the world. And many of these escaped into the desert. probably the greatest place of escape was into the Arabian, into the Egyptian desert, north of the Sahara, out of the major Christian places like Alexandria in Egypt, escaping into the wilderness in order to enjoy a life of solitude. And they had a number of reasons. I mentioned one. They wanted to escape the excesses of the now culturally embraced church. I even mentioned last week that one of the things that came to be was this sense of embracing, or the church leadership embracing this sense of high church culture, and that we, I mean, after all, we have to be like the emperor. He has palaces, and so we should have great cathedrals, and he wears robes, and we should have beautiful robes as well representing Christ. I mean, after all, if he's, you know, sort of the picture of Christ on earth, then we have to have these things. Many of these monks said, we need to get away from those excesses. Those things are going to tarnish the church. And so they left in order to escape those culturally embraced excesses. Secondly, they went away in order to pursue various intellectual things away from the low church standards of the imperial church. When you have a whole lot of people coming to the church who have no knowledge of Christ, really, you're really going to wind up with very low-level Christianity. It's not going to have much depth to it theologically. And so there were many who said, let's go away, pursue intellectual things. Others went to avoid the temptations that permeated normal life amongst other people. Okay, so many people now in the church, so many people bringing the cultural temptations in with them, we need to get away from them. Some went off to escape the demands of the state that would come along in daily living. For example, if you're in the wilderness and you're hiding, who's going to tax you? You're not going to pay your taxes. You're not going to get taxed in that place. So many thought, this is the way to get away. There were others who wanted to provide a communal life of sharing possessions and worldly goods. In other words, sort of going back to the Acts 2 model, where when the church first started, they had everything in common, they shared everything. So they wanted to get back to that picture. Instead of having this population-wide church, let's build a small little community of people that are committed to the discipline of the Lord. And then, of course, there were others in part of this who wanted a chart of life of discipline and asceticism, finding holiness in a world where holiness seemed to be lost. The beginnings of things like celibacy and nunnery began in these days, where the whole idea of giving yourself completely to Christ as a man, so you live a celibate life, or as a woman, becoming a nun, that sort of thing, begins in this period. People separated themselves even from the ideals of marriage and family in order to find discipline and so forth. So that's part of the reaction. That's the reason for this movement is what the church is now experiencing in its new de facto position. There were three forms of this movement. They're easy to figure out. There's the solitary, there's the communal, and there's the hierarchical. Solitary monasticism was the idea of individuals who moved away by themselves from the population centers to pursue a solitary life of discipline and asceticism, having little contact with others as a way to foment holiness. Okay, so we're going to get away from all the excess of the world. We're going to go live in a cave, and we're going to eat figs, and that's going to be all we're going to do, and we're just going to pray and that. And many of these solitary monks didn't even bring books with them. They just lived in their very quiet place, in a cave, basically, to get away from the population centers. Another form, however, was the communal, or what sometimes is called cenobitic form of monasticism, in which instead of having individual people go and hide in a cave, people would come out together as a group and produce a commune. Now, in a strange sort of way, they called it a solitary existence because each individual pursued his own life of discipline and asceticism, but they would do it together. So they would come together, grow their foods, and live their lives together, have communal times of prayer and worship and that sort of thing, and then go back to their individual places. And you're probably familiar with that form of monasticism because it became the most popular through time. All of the various Monasteries, for example, were built around that model. You would go to the monastery, there'd be a whole bunch of people there, but you'd have your own little individual cell that you could call your own, and you would go there, and that's where you live out your life, and you come together for communal meals, do the various businesses of growing food, and then escape back to your little place. So that's a communal form, or a cenobitic form, of the movement. But there's also a third, and this is the one that's kind of bizarre, but most important for our understanding. It's called the hierarchical form of the movement. It's in the population centers where you have large numbers of people gathered. Excuse me. The effects then of this monastic life were being embraced by members of the hierarchy itself. So you would think about this issue of celibacy and nunnery, right? By itself, out in a monastery somewhere, out in a cave somewhere, it doesn't really have much impact upon the church as a whole because it's out there by itself. But many of the bishops in the population centers looked at that lifestyle and said, you know, that's not too bad. We should be doing some of those kinds of things. So how can we bring that kind of thinking into the life of the church in a population center? And so issues like celibacy and nunnery and asceticism and discipline, that sort of thing, started to take hold even amongst the members of the hierarchy, even amongst the bishops and the priests and so forth. This is the beginning, in fact, of a celibate priesthood. Okay? They would look out into these solitary places and go, you know, those guys have something in mind. Now, they're foolish to sit in a cave. I mean, we have access to great food here. I don't know why they go live in a cave. But I do like the idea of not being married in order to dedicate my entire life to the Lord. So I'm going to embrace that. So that's called a hierarchical form of the monastic movement, in which the various bishops, even in the population centers, began to adopt some of the ideas out of the monastic movement. So no particular movement ever lives by itself. It's always in some way embraced other ways in other places. This is an example of it. So even back to the turn of the fourth century, you start seeing the beginnings of things that even continue today. The Roman Church, for example, insists that its priests must be celibate. That's going all the way back to a time even before the Roman Church even existed. The importance of this movement then is singular. I think there's a singular thread through this movement. The various forms of monasticism shared a common thread. The ideal Christian life was one of personal property and sharing of personal poverty and sharing of goods. The communal life is the monastic life. The solitary life became the ideal of living a life of discipline and sharing the things of this world, over against the general church, which no longer needed to think in that way. In some ways, you can almost picture the monastic movement being a rewinding of the clock. We used to be, you know, as a church, we used to be persecuted. We used to have to hide. We used to have to scratch out a living. It was difficult for us to participate in life in general because of the persecution. So now that we have everything we could ever imagine, and in fact, we've even been embraced by the culture and embraced by the imperium itself, maybe we need to go back to a time such as that. That's the thinking process of the monastics. They're thinking about how to differentiate themselves from a church that was becoming bound up with the culture itself to the point where it's hard to tell the difference between where the church ends and the culture begins, and vice versa. And some coming and saying, let's stop and think about how we as a church are to address the realities of a church embraced by the culture. If we're going to be true Christians, how do we do that? That's the question that was plaguing the time. I would argue that in some ways, the modern American church is like the imperial church. If you think about it, the relative peace that we experience surrounding the church over the last 240 years has made her adherence much less drawn to holiness and discipline and doctrine and theology. In other words, once the church becomes so accepted by the culture around her that it becomes watered down by that culture, Which then means that some, prophetically speaking, stand up and say, wait a minute, wait. It's great that we enjoy all this peace and prosperity. And it's great that the church, you know, that the government doesn't come knocking on our door when we start preaching the gospel or worshiping together. But what's the downside to that? What's the flip side to that? What has happened to the church? And if we look at the church, particularly in America since the turn of the century, turn of the 20th century, we can see the realities of this. The vast majority of people who attend church today have little knowledge of doctrinal matters. They have no idea of doctrine or theology. And if you ask them simple questions about the faith, they would have no way of answering those questions. They simply don't know. Additionally, they've embraced the culture around them. They've embraced the ideas of personal happiness being the primary goal of life. And so matters of discipline and asceticism are gone. So in many ways, you have new voices, even today, that are standing up and saying, we need to be thinking about these sorts of things. I've been reading a book recently called Live Not by Lies by Rod Dreher. He wrote another book prior to this called The Benedict Option. The Benedict Option is based on a man by the name of Benedict, who was a monk. Started a monastery, probably the most popular monastery, the most well-known monastery in the history of the church. And Dreher's question, the call that he's making is, maybe now that persecution is back on the rise, maybe now the church is starting to be opposed, what are we going to do as believers in the face of the fact that the culture embraced us is being withdrawn? What are we going to do now? How are we going to address this? What are we going to do in terms of our relationship to the world and to the church? And are we going to have to become more monkish in our approach to the Christian life because we now look at the church as being in the world so much that it's now of the world rather than just being in the world but not of the world? So those are good questions. How do we respond to where we live now? So one of the first controversies that comes up is number of people who are looking at the culture and saying, what do we do about its effect upon the church? But there's a second controversy that goes with it. And almost all church history books will address this particular issue at this time. And it's called the Donatist Schism. Now, if there's one group in the church who looks at the church and sees it as corrupt because of the culture and because of its relationship to the Imperium and runs off to hide in the wilderness, there's another group that responds to this by suggesting that the church itself is simply corrupt and splinters off from the church. In other words, it doesn't walk away from the church, but rather schisms itself off from the church to now create its own version of the church without giving up on the church herself. Now, you remember last week we talked about the issue, maybe it was the week before, anyways, we talked about the issue of those who during the days of the persecution of the church had lapsed in their faith. Remember? We talked about there were many who in the early church under severe persecution would give up their faith, quote unquote. They would lapse in their faith, okay? Well, the issue of the lapsed rears its head at this point. What's the first question that's going to come up when the church now comes back to a time in which it no longer has to deal with that? And the answer is, what do we do with those who lapsed during the days of persecution, but now want to come back in to the life of the church? Now that the church is no longer being persecuted, now that they can come back, what do we do with them? What do we do with those who lapse in their faith? In North Africa, Libya, Egypt, the persecution had been particularly strong during the first three centuries of the church, and the issue once again appears in that place. And this included bishops of the church during the days of persecution, who had handed over to the authorities various things in order to avert persecution from the Romans. When the Romans would come and say, will you give up the faith? These men would give away to the Romans things from the church, various vessels and things in the church. But many of them would also hand over copies of the scriptures to the authorities to be burned, to be destroyed. And so this issue comes back up. And at this particular point, there's a group who believes that a new rigor needs to be brought by the confessors. The confessors are those who continue to remain faithful even during the persecution. They're over against the lapsed who fall in the persecution. There's many in the church who now say, we need to raise up a new level of rigor in terms of how we readmit the lapsed. There are some at this point who are saying, just let them back in. Who cares? Doesn't matter. Just let them back in. They failed, that's true, but even under the gospel, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, and so we'll just bring them back in. But there was a group of Christians that said, no. We need to be much more careful here. We need to be much more rigorous about how we invite the lapsed to come back into the church, particularly bishops who have lapsed, those in leadership who lapsed. You know, the ordinary Joe in the pew, okay, we can deal with him. But what about the guy that's now up in the front of the church handing out the sacraments, you know, and teaching and preaching? What do we do with that guy? That's a different story. So this issue is what produces the Donatist schism. The movement, the Donatist schism, derives its name from a rival bishop elected in Carthage in North Africa by the name of Donatus. In that particular place, the bishopric was originally given to a man by the name of Cecilian, but he was not popular amongst the rigorists. In fact, it was suggested that one of the men who had ordained him was lapsed himself. And thus, the feeling was amongst the rigorists that because your ordination was declared by a man who himself was lapsed, therefore your ordination was invalid because his ordination was invalid. Okay, and so Cecilian was not popular. And so a rival bishop in Carthage was appointed by the rigorists. They elected their own man to the position, a man by the name of Majorinus. But he died soon after his appointment, and his deacon, a man by the name of Donatus, replaced him. So Donatus rose to the position of being a rival bishop to Cecilian in Carthage. Now, Constantine the emperor eventually declared that Cecilian was the true bishop, and only those who were in communion with Cecilian could receive the gifts of the emperor, such things as freedom from taxation, for example, and etc. By the way, the whole idea of churches not being taxed by the state traces its roots all the way back to the days of Constantine. It's been going on for centuries that this has been the case. Okay, so Constantine was handing out these gifts from the emperor, and he made the declaration, listen, this guy Cecilian, he's the true bishop. That Donatus guy, he is not. So everybody had to come under the bishopric of Cecilian, or guess what? You don't get the gifts from the bishop. So the Donatists, under Donatus, split away. They broke away. They decided to form a rival church of their own in North Africa. And they split over a number of specific issues with the church under Cecilian. Two of them I'll talk about. Number one, as I mentioned a moment ago, they considered the consecration of a bishop by a traitor, Cecilian, a traitor, to be invalid. You were considered to be a traitor to the rigorists if you had handed away scripture during your persecution, if you had given up elements of the church when you were confronted with great persecution, if you had given over, you were considered a traitor, a traitor. So the Donatists said, Cecilian cannot be a proper bishop because he was ordained by a traitor himself. And then secondly, they went one step further. They not only believed that a bishop himself had to be rigorously defended, but they also considered that the church herself needed to be pure and holy. By definition, the church was to be pure and holy. The holiness of individual members determined the holiness of the church itself. What they were insisting on is a very early form of a late heresy known as perfectionism, in which it was believed by the Donatists that once you came to faith in Christ, under the power of the Spirit of God and His Word, you could, in fact, be sinless. That in fact you could be, by virtue of the fact that the Spirit of God could work in you. Notice, they were extreme rigorists. Their position was, holiness is so important that we declare it to be the trait of the church and the trait of the bishops and the trait of all of the individual members inside. And so they split away under this perspective. Now, there's much, much more that can be said about the Donatist schism breaking away, but the Donatists were eventually labeled as heretics by the church at large. The larger church, which still existed both in the East and in the West, declared them to be heretics, and they argued this way. The larger church said, listen, no single person can be sinless. Therefore, no act performed by an elder or a bishop could ever be perfect. No act by an elder or bishop could ever be perfect because he himself is sinful. This was the answer to one of the questions that the elders asked me in coming to the church, was my interpretation of the qualifications of elders that are given in 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1. Can an elder do his work if he is sinful? And the answer is, well, he has no choice. Okay? Nobody is going to be sinless. And Paul is not expecting a sinless perfection in the list of qualifications that he gives. Because even he himself would be disqualified. All I have to do is pull out and show you Romans 7 in order to prove my case. So the issue isn't sinless perfection, the church said. The authority of a person is not derived from his own personal holiness, but from the office he occupies. The holiness of a bishop is not related to how perfect he is, but the office that he comes from. For example, we might utterly disagree with the policies of whoever is residing in the White House, but we should, regardless of that, recognize the office that the person holds. And so if Joe Biden were to invite you to come to the White House, you might disagree entirely with all of his policies, but when he walks in, you would call him Mr. President and give him the honor he deserves. It is the office that establishes the right of the bishop to act in a way of representing God, not the individual holiness of the individual. It's the calling that produces the actions of the bishop being useful to God, not the character of the bishop himself. So the Donatists were told, you're trying to impose an absolute perfection standard upon bishops, which you even yourselves cannot produce. Secondly, the church declared them as heretics because the church will have in it both saved and unsaved. By definition. I mean, even Jesus taught the parable of the wheat and the tares. There will always be tares amongst the wheat. And so they came back and said, the holiness of the church, the judgment of the church in terms of its own holiness must be left up to God. You don't have the authority, Donatists, to discredit a church or disappear from a church simply because you don't think it's holy. That's not up to you. That's up to the Lord to make that particular judgment. Okay. So ultimately, the Donatists were declared as heretics, but they became, strangely enough, the catalyst for a number of Augustine's treatises, a number of Augustine's writings, because Augustine was himself at one time a Donatist. But when he comes out of that movement, he writes back against it in the sense of writing about the doctrine of the church, the centrality and importance of the sacraments, and even his treatise on just war theory comes out of his understanding of the Donatists and their understanding of the church. So, the question that the Donatists raise for us is this: when will it be necessary to split away from a movement that has lost her way and has abandoned the fundamentals of the faith? The Donatists believe that the church at that time had been so severely compromised, particularly the bishops who had been severely compromised by their lapse, that it was time to break away. Which leads us to the perennial question, which has been asked generation after generation after generation. When exactly is it right for us to break away from the institutional church to start something else? This would, of course, arise most specifically in the days of the Reformation. Luther had no intention of starting a new church over against Rome. He intended for the Church of Rome to be reformed. But there came a point when it was obvious it could not be done. And so a new church had to be started. A schism had to be made. And even today, this is a question we may have to ask ourselves. When exactly do we as a church or even as a denomination split away from heretical ideas or issues that are threatening to destroy the very fabric of the church herself? This has always been a question. It has never been completely and rightly answered. And the Donatists, I think, went too far. They pushed the envelope into this idea of perfectionism. We don't have to go quite that far, but we can certainly ask the question, how far is too far when leaders stand up and begin to espouse heretical ideas that, if they're allowed to foment in the church, become a poison that kills the church herself? Those are always going to be questions we're going to have to deal with. So, notice, the monastic movement looks at the church and says, okay, now that we're enjoying a period of prosperity, the church has become compromised, let's escape. The Donatists look at the church and see it's become corrupted, so instead of escaping, let's all go start our own church and walk away. Okay, so those are the first two great controversies that are found now that the imperial church has embraced a relative period of peace and prosperity, which leads us to the third great controversy of this time, the Arian controversy. Some historians, and I would agree with this assessment, that the Arian controversy is by far the single greatest controversy that the church ever had to deal with. The single greatest controversy that the church ever had to deal with, because it addresses the very nature of God himself and the very nature of Christ himself. In fact, you could make an argument that the Arian controversy that begins at the beginning of the 4th century bleeds over into several centuries to follow, even to our day, which I hope to show you at the end of this discussion. The Arian controversy itself begins in the city of Alexandria in Egypt, North Africa. And it started, surprisingly, even before Constantine became emperor. It started even in the days of persecution, but it really grew after that. The beginnings of this controversy were a controversy over the concept of the Logos. Okay, you know that word. You find it in John chapter 1. It is the word translated word in uppercase, right? W-O-R-D. Word, Logos. It is a Greek word that means revelation or to speak forth. Theology is the word theos and logos together. Theos being the word of God, the word God. Logos being revelation. You put the two words together, it means literally to talk about God. So logos is to express, to speak forth, to reveal, that sort of thing. Okay, it's a very broad Greek term, a biblical term itself, but even existed beyond the Bible itself. Now, this was largely an issue in the Eastern Church, the Greek-speaking Church. In the West, the issue was largely moot, for reasons I won't get into. This particular issue was particularly expressed by two of the early Church Fathers, Jerome and Origen. These two men suggested some things theologically that brought this to a head, all right? First, the Supreme Being, God, is both immutable and impassible. He is immutable, meaning that he is unchangeable. There's nothing that can change God. He is a being who is unchanged by anything outside of himself, because all things outside of himself are derived from him, because all things are dependent upon him and created by him. Therefore, he is unchangeable. Nothing in the creation changes God. But he's also impassible in that he's unchanging. So he's unchangeable, but he's also unchanging. He does not change. He remains the same today, tomorrow, yesterday, and forevermore. He is Yahweh, who has been, always has been, and always will be, and is unchanging. Okay, so immutability and impassibility are fundamental doctrines of God that were espoused by the early church. Origen and Justin or Jerome, for example, bring these up. But the creation itself is constantly changing. Everything in creation changes, right? I mean, we live in a world of absolute change. You are not the same person you were 10 years ago. Everything changes. The whole world changes all the time. Today you walk outside and something is different than it was yesterday. You are different. That's just the reality of the world. So the thinking is how do we understand this concept of the Logos, the reason of God, the nature of God in which he expresses his nature and his character into the world, considering that the Logos of God is personal and capable of relationship. Let me put it in a more simpler way. How does an unchanging God have a relationship with a changing world? If God himself is unchanged and unchangeable, and yet everything in creation changes, how does that mesh? How do you get a God who never changes to have a relationship with a world that is constantly changing? So that the Logos is understood by the early theologians to be, if you will, the mediation between an unchangeable God on the one hand and a changing world on the other. The way that early Christians consider the Logos is they looked at this idea of Logos, not as Jesus, but as the very nature of God revealing himself. You can almost think of the Logos as almost a separate thing coming out of God that mediates between him as unchangeable and a world that is changing. There's a middle thing in between, if you will, called the Logos. It is a nature of God or a part of God or the revelation of God, the speaking forth of God, in which he crosses that infinite boundary between unchangeable and absolutely changing all the time. Okay? You with me so far? Have I lost you? Okay. Now, of course, we understand that the Logos is connected to Jesus, right? Because John makes that connection. So the early Christian church took that idea of Logos, understanding what John had written there, to say, aha, when God decided, the unchangeable, immutable God, decided to have relationship with the world, the Logos of God became flesh and dwelt among us. The very nature of God that comes between those two things that are virtually opposite of one another or contradictory to one another, the Logos, Jesus, then comes in between to come and bring a relationship with God. In other words, the unchangeable God from eternity past becomes a man, dwells among us to have a relationship with us, so that the immutable God is now present in a human who can now relate to a world of changing everything. You see? So, the question is, what was this Logos? What was this Logos, and how did it come into being in Jesus Christ? Trinitarian Christianity has been a part of it from the very beginning. Okay? Let me make it clear. Christians from the very earliest time of the faith believed in a Trinitarian version of God, that God is one God in three distinct persons. A God of a single nature and three distinct persons. That's been going on since the days of the Apostle Paul. Even Jesus himself, I've pointed this out a number of times, have I not? That in the Gospels, Jesus himself is extraordinary Trinitarian in his approach. The Gospel of John, more than any other, is particularly shows how Jesus believed that he, as the Son of God, was co-equal with God and yet at the same time distinct from the Father. And he speaks also the Spirit in that same way, being distinct from himself and yet co-equal with himself. So Trinitarian Christianity has existed all the way along, but this is the first real attack upon Trinitarian Christianity from inside the church. Strangely, it was an attempt to defend orthodoxy against outside interpretations of Christian thinking, because what is the first thing that the Jews did? What's the first accusation that the Jews made against the Christians? Answer: they declared them to be polytheists. The Jews said to the Christians, you worship multiple gods. You worship the Father, but you also worship this Jesus. Therefore, that's two different gods. Christianity recognized that Jesus, the Son, and the Father were one and the same, but there were always attacks from the outside, but this is an attack from the inside. This is an attack from inside the church, which, by the way, you will discover over the next 1,800 years of our discussion that the greatest heresy of the church always come from inside the church, rarely from outside the church. Okay? Now, how did it actually begin, and how did it go along? There were two men in Alexandria who were the protagonists in the story. One protagonist, one antagonist. Okay. The bishop of the city was known as Alexander. Ironically, in the city of Alexandria, the bishop was named Alexander. He insisted that the Logos was, in fact, co-eternal with God. He took the conservative orthodox position that from the earliest times of the Christian church, the church has understood that the Logos of God, as John describes him in John 1, is co-eternal with God in every sense. But there was a presbyter in town, a well-known and well-respected presbyter in town by the name of Arius, who insisted that the Logos was not eternal, but in fact had been created at some time in eternity past, that the Logos was the firstborn of God, the firstborn creature of God. Arius's motto was simple, quote, "There was when he was not," unquote. Let me say that again. There was when he was not. The implication of that statement being there was a time, okay, because time doesn't matter in eternity, but there was a time when the Son, the Logos, did not exist, but that the Father created him and created the Logos. Now, both men agreed that Jesus preexisted his own incarnation. Okay, both men agreed that before Bethlehem, the Son of God existed. But Arius insisted that he was created by the Father in eternity past. Arius attacked the orthodox position as being polytheistic. Again, you Christians are embracing two gods. You can't do that. Both agreed that Jesus had secured a salvation by entering into human history, that the Logos had come and secured a salvation, but Arius insisted that Jesus' obedience was meaningless if he was divine. Arius insisted that Jesus must be a created being in order to come as a created being to make salvation for created beings. So Alexander and Arius have a significant disagreement over the very nature of God himself, and as you can see, the nature of Christ, the nature of the Son. So it all came to a head when Alexander deposed Arius of his position as a presbyter in the church, banished him from his position, rightly so, I believe. But Arius began appealing to other bishops. As I said, he was well known and well respected. So he began to appeal to other bishops in the empire. And he began to produce a following of people who went with him in this thinking. Ultimately, then, Constantine the emperor had to deal with it. Or decided, I think a better way to say it, is he decided to deal with it. Okay? So he intervened and he called the first ecumenical council at Nicaea. An ecumenical council means worldwide, everybody, okay? So he called for bishops to come from all over the empire to come to the city of Nicaea, which is modern-day Iznik in Turkey. I think I have pictures from Iznik, actually. And he calls an ecumenical council, and he pays for them to come. He gives them their per diem to come. He pays for their expenses, which is ironical, isn't it? Because just a few years earlier, the church finds itself being persecuted by the empire. Now it finds itself in a position where the very bishops of the church are being paid for by the emperor to come and deal with a theological problem. Now, Constantine had originally tried to get the two men to just deal with their difference. He sent a representative to him and said, hey, kind of work it out. But they couldn't. Because you will notice that the two positions are utterly contradictory to one another. Only one of them can be correct. Either the Logos is co-eternal with the Father and has always existed, or he was a created thing. There's no mediating position between them, so it needed to be addressed. Now, the council comes to play in 325. Notice we're just inside the 4th century now. Comes to play in 325. The entire council lasts 3 months. At first, they come along and they deal with a few just issues that needed to be addressed in the churches, relating to the fact now that the church has become the de facto standard of religion in the empire. Right? Okay. So there's some issues that have to be dealt with. We talked about some of them earlier. What do we do about the lapses that come back in? So the council dealt with that. The council put together procedures for the election and ordination of presbyters and bishops. Okay? We need a standard for how that happens. They establish an order of precedence of the various episcopal sees, which one are more important than the others around the empire and so forth. And then they establish various regulations regarding the transfer of leaders from one city to another. In fact, they specifically said, if you are ordained a bishop in one city, you cannot move to another and take your ordination with you. That was pretty much ignored. Now, the council then dealt with the primary issue that it had been called to deal with, and that, of course, is this issue. Now, Arius himself was a presbyter, not a bishop, so he was not invited to come to stand in the chamber. This wasn't done in a church, by the way. It was done in an imperial building. And he was not allowed to come. So his small group was represented by a man called Eusebius of Nicomedia. That name will come up later. He comes and he gives the position of Arius and his followers. Alexander himself came because he was a bishop, and he represented the small group opposed to Arius' position. One of his deacons, a man by the name of Athanasius, came along with him but could not come in because he also was not a bishop. He was only a deacon, but he became later, ultimately, the champion of Nicene Orthodoxy. His name will come up later. In fact, we may spend an entire lecture on just him by himself. Strangely and ironically enough, the bishops in the room really didn't know how to deal with the issue. Most of them are like, well, I'm not sure how to deal with this. So Eusebius of Nicomedia gets up to make Arius's case. And it is his own speech that causes the bishops in the room to stand and yell heresy. Some of them grab his notes out of his hand, tear them up, and throw them on the floor and stomp on them. The very man who came to defend the position convinces the bishops in the room that the position is a heresy, which is interesting. It is Eusebius's claim that Christ was but a mere creature that provoked the cries of heresy. Arius' position that the Logos was created, thus, by definition, Jesus was a created being. Yes, the Logos was created in eternity past, long before the earth was created. But he was a created thing. Thus, by definition, Jesus, walking around on earth, was a created being from the Father, not co-eternal with God. And it is that very statement that caused them to cry out in heresy. Now, the bishops at this point then said, okay, how do we address this? At first, they tried to build a case against Arianism just using Scripture. Okay, just take out the Bible and take passages from Scripture. But they soon realized the difficulty of that because every passage they brought up, the Arians had a proof text to go in the other direction, right? I mean, they quote passages like, he is the firstborn of all creatures. So the Arians would say, see, even Paul says he is a created being, okay? Misunderstanding and using out of context the passage, but nonetheless, you know, doing the proof text thing never works because the other side always has a proof text to go against your position. So the council decided to take a unique approach. And the unique approach was to develop a creed which would establish the nature of Jesus. They would take language that they would use to say, this is what Orthodoxy believes about the very nature of God. Let me read you just a small part of it. And we believe in one Lord Jesus Christ, the Son of God, the only begotten of the Father, that is, from the substance of the Father, God of God, light of light, true God of true God, begotten, not made, of one substance with the Father, through whom all things were made. Now, the key word in that phrase is the phrase of one substance. The Greek word is homoousios. Strangely enough, it is Constantine himself who suggested this word to be included in the Creed. Strangely, now, there's no way in the world that Constantine knew that word would apply. He had counselors, undoubtedly, that whispered in his ear and said, hey, what we're talking about here is homoousios, of one substance, of the same substance as God. So he suggested it, and the bishop said, yeah, that's the word. To understand the nature of the Logos, we understand that the Logos is the very substance of the fullness of Yahweh himself. There is nothing in the Father that is not also in the Son, because they are of the same substance. Thus, the Logos cannot be created, because that would be of a different substance than the Father, because everything the Father creates is separate from himself. No, the Son is begotten of the Father. The word begotten here literally means to exude from, in the sense that the Son is unique from the Father, and that he exudes from the Father to a unique person, but yet is of the fullness of the same substance as the Father himself. Okay? Probably about the closest thing we have in our way of thinking today as a clone is the idea of homoousios. But even a clone is not of the same substance, because you've got to start with something outside of the original being to build the thing. You start with the DNA, but you still have to have something else to grow it to and from. So even a clone doesn't really work. There's really nothing in the human experience that would even come close here. So they had this grand debate, and most of the bishops signed the new creed. Obviously, the Arian bishops were accepted from signing it. They did not. But those who refused were declared heretics and deposed from their positions. And Constantine even added a civil sentence to their heresy. This is the first time that the Imperium has actually put a civil punishment upon members of the clergy for something they have done wrong inside the church. Now, you will notice then how it's intertwining the church and the state to the point now where the emperor, who is not a bishop, if you consider himself one, but he's not, he's obviously outside of the church being a member of the state, he comes into the church and declares, this man is not only a heretic, but here's the civil punishment I'm putting upon him. Okay? All right, so this is the beginning of that sort of thing. Now, you would think that that would be the end of the discussion. The First Ecumenical Council comes along, it meets, it declares this Arian controversy to be a heresy, deposes all of the bishops who believed in it, adds a civil punishment to it. That should be the end of it, right? Nope. It didn't go away. In fact, it grew. Arianism grew after Nicaea. And its spread was, ironically, largely political in nature. Remember that guy by the name of Eusebius of Nicomedia that I mentioned a few minutes ago, who came in and read the position of Arius and attempted to defend it? Well, guess what? He just happened to be related to Constantine. And after he was deposed and exiled, he managed to worm his way back into the good graces of the emperor. He managed to work his way back into convincing Constantine that he was correct in regards to the Arian position. And it was Eusebius of Nicomedia, even, who baptized Constantine on his deathbed. Now, to make a very long story short, after Constantine's death, a series of political intrigues and civil wars amongst the sons of Constantine, who took over his rule, eventually led to a place where the entire church had embraced Arianism, to the point where it was said by one historian, the whole world woke up to discover it was Arian. The original idea of Nicaea to label Arianism as a heresy and to drive it back out of the church failed miserably, to the point where the vast majority of the church, just shortly after the death of Constantine, winds up being Arian. Now, we'll deal in a future lesson of how Athanasius will work to become the single bishop to strike back against Arianism and push it back into history and recover the Orthodox position that we embrace today, even in the Nicene Creed, that the Father and the Son are of the same substance, a homoousios, yet are distinct as persons. That's a Nicene formulation that Athanasius, the former deacon of Alexander, will recapture. But we have to leave that for another lesson. But let me just pause and note something here. Just as Arianism became alive and well in the church in the early ages, in the fourth century, so it is alive and well today. It is very much alive and well today. When a Jehovah's Witness comes knocking at your door, they are a living embodiment of Arianism. You ask them their position on who Jesus is, and they will tell you that Jesus is a created being given divine power by God. They are living Arians. Mormons are as well, not as obliquely as Jehovah's Witnesses are, but they are nonetheless. They don't embrace Jesus as Yahweh himself because they actually believe that God, Yahweh, was once a man who lived here on this planet, now lives on another planet, and all of his children can become gods at some point, having their own planets to rule over at some point in the future. So they dismiss the idea of Jesus as the Son of God as well. So they're functional Arians, but the Jehovah's Witnesses are literally practicing Arians. Okay? You can have an interesting discussion with them about their interpretation of John 1:1 if you want, because their interpretation is, in the beginning, the Word was with God, and the Word was like God, or something to that effect in their translations. Which reminds us of this fact, and we'll close with this. There will always be heretical teachings in the Church of Jesus Christ. This is really only the first of many that are going to show up that we're going to be discussing in the church history class, because the church has always been rocked by people inside the church who come to change orthodoxy to mean what they want it to mean. There will never be a day we'll escape this. We are living in those days even now. There's much heresy running around in modern Baptist churches that most people don't even realize. In fact, I would argue that the vast majority of Baptists today are actually heretics when it comes to their understanding of the Trinity. Practicing heretics in terms of their understanding of the Trinity. And there will not always be clear and easy solutions for dealing with such matters. The Council of Nicaea thought it had figured out a way to solve the problem. It didn't. And there will always be a need then for us as believers to understand what these things are. We must understand, number one, very clearly what the Bible actually teaches. But then we must also be clear of what the heretics are actually teaching themselves. Because if you haven't noticed in Jude, the point that Jude is making is these guys slip in unnoticed. They're teaching sound orthodox, but in fact they're unorthodox, and if followed to their logical endpoint, the result is disaster. So we need to be clear on what we believe and why we believe it, and then we really need to understand what the heretics are teaching, which is why it's okay for us to discuss matters that are coming up in the church that might seem obscure and inane to you, but are really very much a part of the conversation that is being leaked into the church in the hope to change your beliefs. Probably no better example in our day than critical race theory. Trust me. This is a poison that's being injected into the church in the language of orthodoxy. But it is a poison that will destroy the very heart of the church in much the same way that Arianism, if it had been left unchecked, would have destroyed the Christian church just a few centuries after Nicaea. So will there always be a need for us to defend the truth? We will need to do so biblically, of course. We need to understand what's in the Bible. But we also need to do so systematically. Theology isn't just this verse and this verse and this verse. There's a systematic understanding of Scripture that we need to have as well. We need to understand how the various doctrines fit together. The doctrine of the Logos, obviously, isn't just about who Jesus is. It's about who God is, the nature of God himself. So there's no distinction, if you will, between a Trinitarian understanding of God and a Christological understanding of Jesus. Those two things are intimately connected together. If God is one God in three persons with one substance and three distinct persons, then that has a great deal of impact upon your Christology. But if you believe that God is actually, you know, of multiple substances, then that clearly changes how you think of Christ. They're intertwined. Okay. So as Christians, we need to be teaching ourselves, and more importantly, I think, teaching our children what the true gospel is, systematically and biblically, so they can be defended against these heresies, which sound good, but are poisonous and dangerous.